What's wrong with him?
No reply. Van Sciver didn't waste words, even when they were not his own.
When am I leaving? She asked.
Now, Van Sciver said through another voice, and disconnected the line. A knock from the rear echoed through the crematorium. Tucking the phone back beneath her swim cap, Candy sighed and walked across the Lysol-scented tiles. She opened the back door. Jaggers stood in the cold, his stringy suit hanging from his bones. He was 5'4", maybe 120. He kept his eyes on her face. No small feat, given what was on display.
Don't get in my way. Don't question my tactics. And I'm not gonna fuck you, she told him. Any questions?
He coughed into a jaundiced fist.
What makes you think I wanna fuck you?
She turned, breezing back to the pulverizer, which had just stopped its brittle grinding. Everyone wants to fuck me once they've been around me a while, she said.
You'll see.
If he took note of her burn scars, he didn't show it. In fact, he seemed entirely unaffected by her body. A sexless mole of a man.
I have our plane tickets, he said. We fly into Kiev and move from there.
We're husband and wife.
Photojournalists for a Canadian travel magazine, he said. You can memorize the specifics on the flight.
Are we backstopped?
Yes. Several phone numbers deep, answering machines. Our editor on standby.
She swept the ash into a tray and then distributed it into various urns lining a shelf against the wall. Fido, Spot, Max.
Ah, Wisconsin, with your stalwart Midwestern values and anachronistic pet names.
She loved it here. It gave her a glimpse of what a real life might have been like. She ran her hands beneath a faucet and dried them across her firm, firm thighs.
One more thing.
She walked up on Jaggers. Her breasts were level with his chin. Still, he neither stepped back nor lost focus.
When we catch up to Orphan X, I get him alive first. Understood?
He gave a faint nod.
Okay.
She started for the door.
Let's go.
He didn't follow.
What?
He gestured to the puddle of fabric behind her in the corner.
You forgot your clothes, he said.
17. Beautiful Monster. Rene despised the mirror. It used to be his friend. In his youth he could spend hours preening, admiring the line of his jaw, the strokes of his collarbones, the way his ass arced firmly into leg. He'd never been exactly handsome, but he could strike the right poses in the right lighting to make himself into something worth looking at. His family never shared his interest in himself. He turned now in the soft light of the master bathroom, regarding the 2-inch deviation of his spinal column. The slightest lateral curve. And yet, it had changed everything. No matter how hard he worked, no matter what sort of discipline he exhibited, that thumb-size bend meant he would never be acceptable in the eyes of his family. The Casseroy name carried with it certain obligations, expectations handed down from generation to generation, gathering moss and heft. His great-great-grandfather had fought in the Civil War, and the Casseroy males made regular appearances in the historical record after that, inevitably linked to combat. Here, a first lieutenant in the Spanish-American War, there an artilleryman in the trenches of Chateau Thierry. The Casseroys were represented in the lesser wars as well, wars no one had ever heard of, wars no one would ever remember were it not for the framed battlefield portraits that lined the dark hallways of his childhood manor. The Sheep-Eater Indian War, the Second Sumatran Expedition, the Red River War. If two forces spit at each other, there you'd find a Casseroy,
brandishing a rifle and a razor-straight spine, the first to show up, like an overeager party guest. His father had stormed Omaha, a muck and blood-drenched affair he never hesitated to relive in the flickering light of the hearth, waving around a glass of century-old Grand Champagne cognac for punctuation. Countless times René had heard that old chestnut about veterans never speaking of their wartime experiences. Would that it were true for the Casseroys, who trotted out every scrape and scare like campfire tales made better by the retelling. Were he not the sole Casseroy heir and the biological end of the line, the pressure might have been less, and the disappointment. Born prematurely, René suffered from asthma and sundry illnesses in his childhood. He wasn't classic Casseroy stock, but he had a passable build and was willing to give it the college try. None of his ailments mattered until he tried to enlist. His scoliosis was so minor it was missed by his pediatrician, and yet the eagle-eyed army recruiter had picked it up in an instant, as had the Navy man. The Marines, even the Air Force. Despite Papa Casseroy's considerable connections, René's application to the CIA didn't make it past the first round. No one wanted him. René was in his mid-twenties when Father threw a clot and cracked his head open on the clawfoot bathtub. Mother, a long-suffering waif out of a Tennessee Williams play, had succumbed to some vaguely defined ailment a few years prior. Father hadn't seemed to mind. She'd given him only one son of inferior make, and René certainly felt no loss of love when she passed. Yet when Father had gone, he felt not just the lifting of an age-old weight from his shoulders, but also an intense loneliness. All the old man's badgering and bullying had at least been a form of attention, an acknowledgement that René Peter Casseroy did in fact exist. His existence was called into further question at the reading of the will, an awful 3-hour affair in the solemn offices of the family attorney, René squirming in an itchy tweed suit, the lawyer stroking his fulsome mustache. Father parceled out the family estate to countless veteran causes, leaving René with a measly couple hundred grand. He would no longer be able to live in the fashion he was accustomed to. For 6 months he withdrew entirely from the world, holed up in a summer home that had yet to fall under the auctioneer's gavel. He knew he was a failure in the eyes of his family and the world. But hearing this fact confirmed so starkly by the walrus mustachioed attorney was almost too much to bear. René had been deemed not worthy of sharing in a Casseroy fortune that dated back to the 1600s. A 2-inch curve of the spine had been enough to bring 4 centuries of prestige and affluence to a halt. His father had unwritten him from history. Perhaps the only benefit of being made non-existent was that he was able to write a new story for himself, play by new rules, ones that favored his strengths. Using nothing more than a lifetime's education in pitilessness, he had assembled a fortune of his own. He now lived in a manner befitting a Casseroy. But rather than being bound by convention or tradition, he did exactly what he fucking wanted. He could control everything. Even, quite possibly, nature and time. He had received only one noteworthy inheritance from his long proud lineage of hale forebears, and yet it would prove more valuable than all the family jewels and dusty paintings put together. An AB blood type, present in a mere 4% sliver of the population. In this, René was exceptional. No, perhaps not exceptional yet, but it would make him so.
it would precipitate his transformation into something worth looking at again. Standing before the mirror, droplets from the shower clinging dew-like to the hairs that furred his sloped shoulders, he saw his deficiencies on display. The sea lion bulge of his pale belly, the half-moons of skin sagging beneath his eyes, the fineness of his hair such that the overhead light shone straight through to the dome of his skull. Now was the hard part. Bracing himself, he thumbed the light switch to high. There he was, in all his starkness, every flaw captured in the unforgiving glare. He began his evening restorative process. Cover-up for his crow's feet, a little concealer applied with a cotton disc to take the dark off the bags beneath his eyes, color corrector for the sunspot staining his left cheek in front of his ear. He'd tattooed on a hint of eyeliner to make his chocolate brown irises pop, but it had been a few years, the ink fading. He made a note to have it redone. Bottles lined the counter, diligent sentinels guarding against the ravages of aging. He filled his water glass to the brim. Down went 3 fish oil pills, translucent and gold, zinc for his skin, calcium for his nails, vitamin E for his follicles, Lipitor for cholesterol, Primavil for blood pressure, Singulair for asthma, Concerta for focus, Clonopin to take the edge off, a second dose of Lexapro to ward off depression, Acidophilus for the gut. He washed down 3 green tea capsules in hopes of speeding the fat-burning process, and then heard David rustling around in the bedroom behind him, and popped to see Alice. With a dropper, he applied Rogaine to the thinning area at the back of his head. It didn't work for the recession at his part, but he sprayed hair filler along the line of exposed scalp, the fibers clinging to his own strands, making them more robust. Propecia would take care of the rest. He wished he could reattain the rich umber shade of his youth, but no matter how often he dyed his hair, it held a fake copper sheen. It took more and more work, and more pills, morning and night, to resurrect himself, pull his body into alignment, reassemble his facade. He stared at himself through his father's eyes, through the eyes of generations of Casserois, and saw what they saw. Someone pathetic and human and frail. He felt the need rise in him, clawing its way up his throat, crying out from his cells. His habits, so expensive, had to be supplied with blood. There was a reason he kept Dr. Franklin on premises. It was expensive retaining a physician of his caliber. The medical equipment was expensive. Everything was expensive. Renee's life was an extravagant machine that required more upkeep every year. A beautiful monster that needed to be fed. Dropping the towel from around his waist, Renee entered the bedroom. David lay nude and languorous, draped across the plush pillows. He cast a glance over a muscled shoulder, and Renee braced himself for the inevitable flash of disgust that flickered through his eyes, before submerging beneath the drugged surface. It cut him to the quick. That flicker. And yet he couldn't blame David one bit. David threw an arm wide, welcoming him to the bed. How handsome he was, with his rosebud lips, soulful eyes, and flushed cheeks. Like something from a pre-Raphaelite painting. Renee approached. You're going into town later tonight? For some fun? That's right. The need clamored inside Renee's chest, a trapped bird. Bring me a fix, he said. David tilted his chin down, a lazy approximation of a nod. Male or female? A few of each, he said. Do you think you can manage?
Of course David could. With his looks and the promise of the chalet, anything was possible. David rolled over, bearing himself. I can manage anything, he said.
18. Flesh and Bone. Locked in his room, Evan paced circles in his boxers, waiting for the fire in the hearth to burn down. It was going at a pretty good clip, the roaring cedar bringing memories of his penthouse perched on the 21st floor of Castle Heights. The logs had been restocked while he was at dinner, and would likely burn through the night. He moved to the sliding glass door and peered out at the mountain rims, barely visible, deeper black in the black night. The north slope was most gradual. That was probably why Renee had parked a sniper there. But were there more long gunners on the other slopes? Evan gauged the rest of the range. A dip to the west looked promising. He'd have to assess it in the cold light of day. For now, he had to keep his head clear, mind and body. The second commandment, how you do anything, is how you do everything. Above all else, Jack had taught him to train his focus, to be one thing at a time, one thing and one thing only. He stretched. The push-ups felt less painful, the bruises dissipating. His ribs still ached. Manny's kick to the gut hadn't hastened healing. But the pain was manageable. He sat on the bed, crossed his legs, aware of the camera charting his every move. Then he closed his eyes and let the hidden lens fade into inconsequentiality, let his focus turn inward, let himself find the breath and only the breath. It moved inside him, a breeze whispering through flesh and bone. The transience of each instant also held its beauty. This one breath, this single moment in time, this one body, impermanent and perishable, and gloriously mortal. There would be this breath, and then another, and at some point he will have drawn enough breaths to be still. He could control only how he chose to spend each one, and only in choice was there meaning. A whippoorwill was at it outside, whistling into the gloom, lonely and haunting. The roar of an engine came audible, drowning it out. Tires crackled across frost-bitten ground. Evan hopped from the bed, stepping out onto the balcony in time to see one of the G-wagons slalom up the drive. It skidded to a stop, the driver's door popped open, and David spilled out. Two men and two women, also in their early 20s, emerged from various doors, pint glasses in hand. A bottle shattered, peals of laughter. Snatches rose to Evan, distorted by distance and the wind. Nice house, dude. I have to pee. David dug a slender white remote from an inner jacket pocket, raised it over his head, and clicked. Lights flared from beneath the eaves, flooding the grounds. The young women tittered, wobbling on high heels.
Whoa, one of the guys said. That's so James Bond.
Gauge earrings the size of silver dollars stretched his lobes to tribal proportions. David turned a circle, arms raised. A bottle of champagne had appeared in one of his hands.
Well, he said, are you coming?
He stumbled drunkenly toward the chalet's front door, the partiers following in his wake. Shivering, Evan watched until they vanished from view. Then he turned and stepped back inside. Standing before the fire was a naked woman. Her jet-black hair, thick and glossy, was swept up in the back, twisted around a chopstick. Wisps fell forward, framing her cheeks, clutching her neck. Her body demanded his attention, but he returned his focus to her face. Smooth, straight nose, olive skin, large dark eyes with prominent lashes. The woman he'd seen Dex manhandling in the barn. Red streaks grasped her wrist where the capillaries had broken. Again, Evan wondered if the episode had been staged for his benefit. Her appearance here, like this, made it seem more likely. She spread her arms, a ta-da gesture. Then, a pronounced frown.
Normally, men look happier to see me.
Her accent was strong but musical. Croatian? Greek? Serbian? Her hands clapped to her sides, sending a shudder through her strong hips.
What's the matter? Don't you like gifts?
Not slaves. She stepped nearer, taking his hand in hers, drawing him to the warmth of the fireplace.
Let's make an exception.
Her mouth was close, her lips full. Heat prickled his skin, not just from the fireplace. She kissed him. It took a good measure of restraint not to kiss her back. She pulled away, more amused than anything else. Then she pivoted him, tented a hand on his chest, and pushed him gently onto the bed. He sat. She sidled close, her breasts brushing his mouth. He was acutely aware of the camera above. "Step back, or I'll move you back," he said. But instead she eased him gently onto the mattress, leaning over him. Her hair fell like a curtain, connecting their faces, caressing his cheek. It was the first time he hadn't seen through a promise, maybe in his entire life. When she looked at him now, her expression was different, her brow pinched, her dark eyes moist. Fear. He realized that she'd let her hair cover their faces to block them from the camera.
"Then we need to fake it," she whispered, "or it will be bad for me."
He whispered back, "He punishes you when someone turns you down?"
"I don't know."
Her teeth pinched her puffy lower lip.
"No one has ever turned me down."
"What's your name?"
"Despi."
"Greek, then. From Despina." She flicked her hair back over one shoulder. He could feel her against him, all warmth and pressure.
"Please,"
she said. He mostly believed her. And yet it seemed a gambit theatrical enough for Renee to have dreamed up. He studied the faint pulse in her neck, thought about the chopstick in her hair. He gripped her at the waist and rolled her over toward the part of the bed the ceiling vent camera couldn't reach. He kept the edge of their bodies in view so as not to give away that he knew about the remaining surveillance. "Here," he said.
"Okay."
She was breathing hard.
"Okay."
She sat up on him, tugged free the chopstick, shook her mane of hair. It resettled as if she'd placed it there strand by strand. She let the chopstick clatter to the nightstand, then ran a finger across the yellowed bruise on his shoulder from the beanbag round.
"You are tough," she said. "But are you tougher than Renee?"
The name brought a faint shudder. "I know enough not to underestimate him."
"That's wise," she said quietly. "You've killed some of his workers."
"How do you know?"
"The men talk."
She was undulating on him, her shoulder blocking the camera above.
"So you did?"
It was taking all sorts of focus and non-focus for Evan to maintain the ploy.
"Yes." "That's what you do? Wait in this little room, dreaming up ways to kill your way out of here?"
"Yes." Her skin carried the fragrance of jasmine. She leaned forward, pressing the softness of her stomach to his. The tips of their noses nearly touched. Her hips worked and worked some more, her eyes watching him appraisingly the whole time.
"How would you kill me?"
"I'd put the chopstick on the nightstand through your carotid artery." Her eyes flared.
"What an ugly thing. To know something just like that."
"Yes," he said. She rolled off him, threw an arm across her forehead, ostensibly worn out. He slid the rest of the way out of the lens's purview. She let her hair fall to the side so she was facing him.
That's why they told me I had to take the chopstick when I left. It was an experiment, to see if you'd fuck me or kill me.
Sadness touched her eyes.
You did neither.
She waited for him to say something, but he had nothing to say.
That's what I am now, she said. A lamb staked to the ground to test the predators.
She got up abruptly, slipping off the bed. She was sure to get the chopstick on her way out. When the door opened, Evan heard multiple sets of footsteps outside. It closed, deadbolts clanking into place, one after the other. He barely had time to consider what had just happened when he heard a familiar hissing from above. Fuck, he said. Gas flooded down on him. 19. Somewhere much, much worse. A hint of cherry blossom laces the air. In other circumstances, it might be lovely. But beneath it is the earthy stink of damp concrete and the coppery tang of blood. Jack stands stooped, one hand clutching the ball of his shoulder to no avail. Blood sprays through his fingers, his blue flannel shirt saturated, his eyes accusing. Darkness prevails. There is the spotlight of Jack and nothing else. Evan watches from somewhere in the gloom, spellbound. They are in parking level 3, or somewhere much, much worse. Jack's mouth pulses, his lips locked shut, but Evan can hear his thoughts. What have you done? Little boy who I loved as my own, what have you done to me? Jack's mouth opens, but instead of words there is only blood, black as oil, loosed as if from a faucet. It sheets over his lower teeth, pours across his chin, streams down his legs. It pools on the floor and spreads, filling the spotlit circle and oozing outward. Evan is helpless, trapped in the darkness. He tries to open his own mouth, but he cannot. When he reaches to see why, bristling sutures poke his tender palm. His lips have been stitched shut. Jack's blood seeps through Evan's shoes, warm and tacky. It waterlogs his socks, claims his ankles, his calves. He tries to cry out, to no avail. He is a mute witness to what he has wrought. The warmth is at his waist now, his pants sodden. His shirt grows heavy, clings to his flesh. The blood rises past his clavicles, fills the hollow of his neck. And then he is under, his eyes wide and comprehending, the world below vast and empty, the universe strained through a crimson filter. 20. No end point. Young voices lit up the parlor. David was being David, making trick shots on the billiard table, mixing drinks behind the bar, licking salt off a young woman's gazelle-like neck before throwing back another amber shot and sinking his immaculate teeth into the embrace of a lime. The other girl slumped on the couch, propping up her forehead with one hand and sloppily texting with a thumb. Her iPhone in its sparkly case slipped from her manicured grip. The young men were doing young men things, pounding pints, warring over the foosball table, enacting elaborate handshakes and high fives. There was free-flowing top-shelf booze, and there were Viennese chocolates and Cohiba Robustos, platters of short-rib sliders and sashimi, kale salad with bacon blue cheese vinaigrette and fresh oysters on spoons. Invisible as stagehands, the least sinister of Rene's rented men circulated and cleared, dressed in servant wear with mandarin collars, the better to hide the menacing tattoos. The more colorful of the men, and certainly Dex, were best kept from view. Pretending to leaf through a Wall Street Journal,
Rene observed from a divan at an avuncular remove. This was his place, the perennial outsider lingering just past the reaches of the social glow. Or as he preferred to think of it, Oz behind the green curtain. Aside from the occasional appreciative nod to their host and benefactor, the kids ignored him. The boy with the soul patch and the tribal earrings, Joshua, had graduated to drinking Johnny Walker Blue out of the bottle. That could prove problematic. Rene didn't want him too dehydrated. He was a burly kid, broad-shouldered and thick-thighed, young enough that his muscle propped up the fat, held it firm. He'd already sweated through his guayabera. Inexplicably, he'd decided to plug into a bling-bling set of cushy headphones and was dancing with his reflection in the tall windows, a sort of airplane flight pattern that involved tilting his arms this way and that, a landing approach with no end point. The laughter reached a manic pitch, warmed with booze and friction. David pressed the girl with the slender neck up against the bar. With an expert flip of his hand, he popped the top buttons of her jeans and wiggled his hand inside. She threw back her head in a manner that suggested more rehearsal than spontaneity. The other boy was on top of the girl on the couch, trying to snap a selfie, and she was cackling, pushing at the balls of his shoulders, her fingers splayed. It was self-conscious, without the benefit of shame, as if they were enacting a scene they'd all studied, a commercial for unlimited cell phone minutes. That was the problem with young people nowadays. Give them their very own pleasure island, and they all reach for a script. Youth is wasted on the young, sure. But it needn't be. Rene let the top of the newspaper crinkle down. Across the parlor, low-lidded and clearly bored, David looked back at him over the girl's shoulder. She hooked her arms around his neck, swaying with the action of his hidden hand, whimpering. She had one of those names that didn't used to be a name. Kendall or Cammy. Her movements grew more sluggish. Her blinks became longer. As her legs buckled, David clasped her around her waist and lowered her to the floor. Over by the windows, Joshua now lay on the rug where he'd fallen, the Beats headphones shoved down around his neck, giving off tinny hip-hop. The tangled couple on the couch had passed out mid-selfie. All that faux youthful abandon, fading down into a rohypnal stupor. Rene rose. One of his narco-butlers had already fetched Dr. Franklin, who entered now loose-limbed and unshaven. As he surveyed the tableau, his eyes attained a surgeon's clarity behind round, rimless lenses. He straightened out of his slouch. Instant sobriety. Despite his habits, he was a man who could find the foundation in a hurry when he had to. Two of the men rolled the girls onto stretchers. Dex entered. With a faint whistle of breath, he hoisted Joshua up off the floor and flopped him over his shoulder. David took hold of the other boy's biker boots and dragged him along after the others as if pulling a wheelbarrow. Rene watched them pass, the kid's arms windshield wipering the floor behind him. Rene felt the need stirring inside him, awakening to the possibility of a meal. "Ready?" Dr. Franklin asked. Rene swept an arm magnanimously. "After you." Following the convoy of unconscious bodies down the hall, Dr. Franklin snapped on one latex glove, and then the other. 21. In Trouble. A buzzing pulled Evan from sleep. Was it in his body? The sheets? No. Under the mattress, vibrating him through the fabric. The princess and the epileptic pea,
Groggily, he lifted his 10-ton head from the pillow, trying to regain his bearings. The buzzing came again. The rum zone? It couldn't be. He rolled off the bed, his knees striking the floor, hands digging the phone out from its hiding place between mattress and box spring. Sure enough, light leaked through the shattered facade. The caller's number flickered, carved up by dozens of hairline fractures. The talk icon at the bottom floated in the sole section of unbroken glass. He held his breath, thumbed the icon. He held the phone to his ear. It took him a moment to recall the script, to remember the words he was supposed to say when he picked up. He forced them out through the drug-induced grogginess.
"Do you need my help?"
"Yes,"
the voice of a boy, high-pitched and scared. Evan knew he was clear of the hidden camera, but he turned his back anyway, leaning against the bed. He pressed his thumb and forefinger to the bridge of his nose, blinked hard around them.
"Where did you get this number?" Evan asked.
"A girl gave it to me. She said you help people and stuff."
The boy was whispering. He sounded somewhere around 10 years old.
"What's her name?"
"Anna something."
"What's she look like?"
"Dark hair. Patchy, like it's falling out in places."
The whisper grew more hoarse, more urgent. The boy's words were distorted ever so slightly. A speech impediment?
"Look, can you help me or not?"
"I can."
"I don't know how much time I have till they catch me. I stole the cordless. I'm under the couch. I'm not supposed to make calls."
"What's your name?"
A hesitation.
"I can't. I can't tell you. I'll get in trouble."
The kid's quick breaths were audible even over the crackle of static.
"If they catch me with the phone, it'll be bad."
Evan listened to the kid's articulation. Not a lisp. He closed his eyes, his brain still gummy from the sleeping gas. It took a moment, but he put it together. "Someone beat you up."
"So what?"
the kid said, his words blurry across a swollen lip.
"I get beat up all the time. Please come. Please help me."
"Where are you?"
"You should see how they keep us here. Like cattle, all lined up."
"Where are you?" Evan asked again.
"Are you coming to get me?"
Evan looked around, the deadbolted door, the caged balcony, the gas-breathing vent. He took stock. First, escape. Second, rescue Allison Siegler. Third, help the kid. "Soon," Evan said.
Then I can't risk saying yet."
"Who else is there?"
"Other boys."
"Where are you from?"
"I don't know. I don't remember."
"Do you have a family? Parents?"
I don't know. It's been so long."
"How long have they kept you?" Evan asked. "How old were you when you were taken?"
"Oh, shit. I can't. They're coming. I'll try and call back. Will you help me? Will you?"
"Yes, I will get to you."
"Promise me."
"I promise."
The broken phone cut out. Evan stared down at the shattered shards held together loosely in the cracked casing of the rum zone. He shoved the phone back into its hiding place and crawled into bed. He imagined Allison Siegler, locked in her container aboard a ship halfway around the globe. Did she have enough food? Enough air? He thought about a little boy also waiting for his help, his words blurred over a swollen mouth. "You should see how they keep us here." Evan's blinks grew heavier. 2 dogs, 10 guards, 1 sniper, Dex, and counting. He'd have to kill a lot more of them tomorrow.
22.
divine right. Propped on a brace of pillows on a regally upholstered gurney, René drew in a deep lungful of air as the needle sank beneath his flesh. This was his favorite moment, when the fix first flowed into his body and set the world quivering with potency. Everything turned vibrant, the colors saturated even down here in the bowels of the chalet. Every sensation felt enhanced. The oxygen in his lungs, the hum of adrenaline hurtling through his veins, the creamy sheets caressing his bare skin. The rush hit his arteries, a surge that rocketed him to his feet. The catheter in his arm couldn't slow him. He seized the IV pole and dragged it beside him, one stubborn wheel giving off a squeak. His finest bequeathment, an AB blood type, served him exquisitely. Having both key antigens and neither constraining antibody made him a universal recipient. Anyone could give it to him. Few could receive from him. He was a taker. He hadn't merely resigned himself to this fact. He embraced it as divine right. Sure of foot, his back ramrod straight and unaching, he threaded through the youthful bodies lying prone and unconscious on their gurneys. Through the dim light, he moved erect and proud, an ageless sovereign lording over his minions. All was right in the great chain of being. He swore he could already feel the pyrotechnics exploding through him. His aging tissue rejuvenating, tired muscles mending, new neural connections sprouting in his hippocampus. His heart, his brain, even his cartilage reviving. His memory fortifying, liver cells generating. He felt swollen with vitality, with youth, with timelessness. Even his sense of smell grew more keen. This was no trick of the mind. From across the basement lab, he picked up a trace of dewy perfume on the slender neck of David's girl. Kendall was an AB type, too. Unlucky dove. She would receive from him tonight. And that would cost her. Each of the guests had to be replenished, and there was no use wasting valuable O-neg from the freezer, when she could take what had to be drawn out of Renee to make room for the new. For time immemorial, man had searched for the fountain of youth. From Herodotus's recitations to Ponce de Leon's hapless wanderings, it had cast a mythological shadow across the ages, silver chalices and bubbling springs. Who would have thought it had been right in front of everyone all along? Someone just required the audacity to take it. If you considered it, really considered it, this was a move befitting a Casseroy. Rather than forging through enemy fire to claim some godforsaken battle-torn hill, René had fought his way through social mores and human limitations to stake his flag in the virgin terrain of an age-old fantasy. Passing among his unsuspecting acolytes now, he brushed against dangling bags of blood, as bright and cheerful as Christmas decorations. That was when he heard a groan behind him. He halted, turned. There was movement in the bed, where there was supposed to be none. And then Joshua sat up. The kid was not supposed to come to for another few hours. Dr. Franklin rarely got the dosing wrong. But the bigger the fellow, the more unpredictable the anesthesia. All that mass, it seemed, gave the boy the tolerance of a water buffalo. It was awful when they woke up in the middle. They got so confused. It wasn't just the whir of the processing machines, the hum of the medical refrigerators, the white noise rush of the benchtop centrifuges, all of it amplified off the basement walls. nor the smells, the sharp tang of rubbing alcohol, the nail polish reek of iodine, the hospital room whiff of PVC tubing and dried sweat. The sights weren't what did it either. Not the needles plunged into their flesh, the blood piping from their veins, their acquaintances laid out in neighboring beds, dead to the world. Not the scrape of the sanitized pillowcase at their nape, not the taste, old pennies at the back of the tongue. It was the vertiginous sense of dislocation. They were no longer in the world as they knew it. No. This gave them a glimpse of the world as it really was. Might is right. Eat or be eaten. Accrue resources or starve. Repeated again and again and again, because all 10,000 years of civilization had been built upon mankind's desire to deny this fundamental truth. Rene tried to protect them from reality. They were supposed to pass out full-bellied, drunk and happy. Never know the difference. He was greedy, sure, but not inhumane. No sense spooking the livestock on their way to the abattoir. And yet now Joshua was certainly spooked. He reared up from his gurney, tubes snaking around his bulging arms, IV poles crashing over. Rene unhooked his own IV bag and dashed away, using Kendall's gurney as a shield. He was too charged to feel fear, but a dark excitement gripped him. Tingling electrified his body, his gums, his arms, the skin of his lower back. Joshua's head pivoted, fixing on Rene. Even across the gurney, Rene registered the wounded rage and stripped bare terror lurking behind the dilated pupils. It gave him a heady, almost sexual rush. He wondered if this is what his ancestors had felt charging through the fray, shrapnel grazing their cheeks. Joshua lunged at Rene, sending the gurney skidding. Dead to the world, Kendall rolled to one side, smashed beneath Joshua's weight. Scrambling toward them, Dr. Franklin tried to hit the kid with a syringe of Versed, but with all the flailing he couldn't get to the port. Joshua clawed across the unconscious girl, his churning legs propelling the gurney until Rene was backed to the wall, Joshua's straining fingers inches from his face. That was when Dex stepped in. However big the boy was, he looked like a puppet in Dex's hands. Dex lifted him in a chokehold. There was a crackling sound, and then Joshua poured limply from Dex's arms onto the floor. Silence reasserted itself in the basement. Joshua lay still, one dead palm pressed to the concrete. This was not a substantial problem. Come morning, Rene would generate some excuse to cover for the boy's absence. He'd peddled such excuses before. If the others showed bruising from the needles, he would instruct David to tell them that in their drunken state they'd played around with heroin one of the kitchen workers had brought. Not to worry. What happened at Chalet Savoir-Faire stayed at Chalet Savoir-Faire. And that's what would happen. The best way to ensure silence was to bury the truth beneath shame. From over by the door, David coughed out a note of disbelief, hugging himself around the waist, his arms trembling. Dr. Franklin leaned against a cabinet, flushed from the scare. Rene, too, was breathing hard, though not from fear. He'd never felt more alive. He looked down at the IV bag compressed in his fist, now depleted. In all the excitement, he had rapid-bolused the final unit into his arm. All that fresh young blood bathing his stem cells, turning back the clock. With a furrow of his shiny forehead, Dex looked past Joshua's slumped body at Rene. He seemed unclear which mouth the present circumstances called for.
Renee pointed to Dex's right hand. Dex raised the smile, folded it across his mouth.
Yes, that looked appropriate. It was, after all, a happy occasion.
23. Destroying Angel. When Manny and Nando came to get Evan for his walk, he took some extra time to layer his clothes, donning two shirts and two sweaters. They'd brought both breakfast and lunch on the room service cart earlier, making Evan stand against the wall with his back turned until they exited. The new procedures were effective. They maintained their spread now as they guided him down the halls and stairs to the foyer, one shotgun aimed at his face, another at his kidneys. Manny gestured at the front door, his gold cap sparkling.
"You get your yard time now, just like in the prison,"
Evan said. "Trade you two cartons of cigarettes for a shiv." Manny looked at him, puzzled, then jerked his gun.
"You go."
The doorknob felt cold enough to stick to Evan's hand. When he stepped onto the porch, the cold flew straight through the layers of clothes and tightened his skin. He stomped his boots, blew a breath that clouded and faded away, a ghost that couldn't be bothered. Over by the barn, David corralled three of the partiers into one of the G-wagons. The kid with the gauge earrings must have either left last night or was already in the vehicle behind the tinted windows. The three kids in view looked wan and weak, no doubt atrophied from first-rate hangovers. One of the girls in particular moved creakily, clinging to David, her legs barely strong enough to push her into the back of the Mercedes. Her face was gray, her lips bloodless. She coughed weakly into a sleeve-covered fist. David helped her gingerly into the rear seat, closed the door, then paused for a moment with his back to the van, his head tilted up at the sky, his lips trembling. He seemed upset, conflicted. He lowered his gaze, noticed Evan noticing him. But he didn't look away, not even as he blinked back tears. Finally, he walked around to the driver's seat and drove off. From the porch, Evan watched the vehicle head up the gravel road, and then it was just him and the cold. From here on out, the math was simple. He had to mark the position of every one of Renee's hired men, then kill them. The skinny guard in the tower leaned on the railing, eyeing Evan. Evan waved. The guard did not wave back. Across the way, three narcos were gathered at their post by the barn. Evan envied their heavy black coats. The scorched pot hung over the fireplace, and their heads were bowed as they shoveled food from bone china plates. The Dobermans idled beside the men, pointed at him, rumbling. Evan gestured at the forest inquisitively, and one of the narcos waved his fork in response.
"Be our guest."
The guard muttered something to the others, and they laughed. As Evan hiked up to the trees, their amusement became clearer. Despite the sweaters and shirts he was wearing, the cold asserted itself in his joints. Already his feet felt numb in the hiking boots. He could hold out for an hour, maybe two, but without heavier clothes and a fire, hypothermia would set in. However, escaping wasn't today's plan. From the edge of the woods, he looked back. Two magenta circles winked at him from the tower, the guard's binoculars tracking his movement. The big chimney behind him sighed a tendril of black smoke. Evan paused to search for that notch in the western rim of the mountains. The silhouette had looked promising last night, but now, seeing the sheer face leading up to it, he felt his hopefulness evaporate. The southern rise was higher, but the ascent more gradual. A viable second option if the northern route proved unmanageable. As Evan turned back, something caught his eye on the distant treetops. A large bird perched in the upper reaches of a pine tree,
Its white head is pronounced as a golf ball against the dark tones of the forest. He did a double take, focusing his gaze. A noise from the tower carried to him on the breeze, the guard talking into a radio. A moment later, a hidden rifle cracked and the bird disappeared, a few feathers floating in the space where it had been. Evan's brain was still working on what his eyes had just seen, the imprint of that bird floating in the white space. A visual memory. A bald eagle. In Switzerland. Not likely. He understood now why the tower guard had relayed word to the sniper to remove it from the picture. Rene could control a lot, certainly, but not nature. Not wanting to give away what he'd seen, Evan didn't dwell. Continuing quickly up through the trees, he berated himself for forgetting the first commandment. Assume nothing. He was in North America somewhere. Vermont, maybe. Alaska or Canada. Rene wanted him to believe he was halfway around the world on the desolate edge of the Alps, a further disincentive to escape. But he was closer to home than that. He remembered hearing that whippoorwill last night, annoyed that he didn't know what region the damn bird was indigenous to. Jack would have chided him for not paying better attention during wilderness survival skills. Really, Evan? It took a bald friggin' eagle to pin you down on a continent. But this was good news, too. Closer to home meant he was closer to Allison Siegler, and closer to the kid who had called. Evan hiked to the clearing he'd made it to last time. There was no buck at the water's edge, no loon in the half-frozen puddle, just a porcupine feeding in a treetop, sprinkling down needles, 40 pounds of quilled bowling ball. Evan looked up the ridgeline, hoping to catch a glint from a scope to place the sniper. No such luck. Wind whipped his cheeks raw. He thought about the perfect shot placement that had dropped the buck, 2 inches behind the shoulder, slightly below the midline of the body, straight through the lung to the upper heart. The tournament-worthy round to knock the bald eagle from the treetop. Even more impressively, both shots had been made from a cold bore. He searched the ground, spotting a pine cone. He retrieved it, placed it on the flat of his palm, held out his hand, and faced upslope. A challenge. He waited. Waited some more. A muzzle flashed high on the slope, and the pine cone exploded, seemingly at the same instant. Shrapnel flecked his cheeks as the supersonic crack echoed around the bowl of the valley. Evan's stomach had leapt into his throat at the impact, but he focused, judging the sound, gauging the distance. A high-power, major-caliber rifle was in play, 30-caliber or bigger. Given that the shooter could take a pine cone off a flattened hand at 500 meters, he could probably hit critical mass at 3 times that distance. Committing the sniper's position to memory, Evan nodded respectfully toward him, lowered his hand, and started back toward the house. Halfway down the slope, he became aware of a stinging in his palm. A closer examination revealed that a few splinters from the pine cone had been embedded in the skin. He picked them out with his teeth and spit them to the wind. The guards no longer held their spot by the fire outside the barn. The wide door was rolled back slightly, and he could hear them inside. The tower guard remained alert above, watching Evan's every move, the binoculars swiveling with him like a part of his face. Rather than veering toward the porch, Evan continued past the chalet and into the tree line on the other side. He made his way up the southern slope a short distance, the chill razoring beneath his skin. The sun was low, the sky textured with dusk. He didn't have much more time before the cold would drive him inside. An outcropping of shale shaved a treeless patch on the mountainside. Evan clambered onto the rock and stood, eyeing the rise, thinking about where he'd tuck in himself if he were behind a sniper scope. A gully two-thirds up provided an ideal vantage of the surrounding terrain while guarding the pass. Evan hopped off the rock, found another pine cone, and returned to his position in the open. He displayed the pine cone on his outstretched hand, held his breath, closed his eyes.